They're getting ready to close the long room at Trinity College's old library in Dublin. It's to start a long overdue restoration of the dusty and historic collection where the 1,200-year-old Book of Kells is displayed. In just a bit, Guides from Ireland update us on what's new in Dublin and recommend not-to-be-missed sights and experiences to fully enjoy the Irish capital. And we'll open the phones to hear from listeners about the lengths they go to view the art they admire in person. Planning a trip to see a work of art where it's meant to be seen can make a huge difference. Let's start today's travel with Rick Steves, getting to know the story behind Michelangelo and how he struggled for years to build an elaborate tomb that was supposed to be his greatest work of all. When traveling in Italy, you can hardly avoid Michelangelo, his compelling life story, his prolific work as both a sculptor, a painter, and an architect, and his role as sort of the face of the Renaissance. It's inescapable to any art lover traveling in Italy. Virtually every tourist has Michelangelo's David, his Pieta, and the Sistine Chapel on their bucket list. But what few travelers know is the project that dominated so much of Michelangelo's career was a massive tomb for the greatest pope of his lifetime, Pope Julius II. And while Michelangelo struggled to complete the tomb, the very vision of the audacious tomb sparked the creation of lots of great art that continues to fascinate travelers today. Gene Openshaw is a friend and fellow tour guide who I've collaborated with since the day we graduated from high school. He's co-authored many of my books and TV scripts. Anytime I have a writing project with a focus on art or history, Gene's the guy I want at my side. Gene has just finished a multi-year project writing a book about the long and winding story of that audacious tomb. The book's called Michelangelo at Midlife, Chasing the Tomb of Julius II. And Gene joins us now for a little quality time with perhaps the greatest artist of all time. Gene, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here, Rick.
Man, your book takes us on a fascinating trip. It's like a journey of discovery across Europe, tracing clues and the mysterious project. Give us a little context about this.
The story of the tomb of Julius II is probably one of art history's greatest mysteries. And the book traces, as you say, those clues all across Europe. And it stops in places that travelers today would fully recognize. You know, it starts in Florence, Michelangelo's hometown. People today walk the same alleyways and same streets and see the same Brunelleschi's dome that Michelangelo saw. Then it goes to Carrara, where Michelangelo quarried marble for the tomb.
Mm-hmm.
It makes stops in Venice, where Michelangelo escaped from his troubles. And then he goes into Tuscany, where he, well, frankly, where he enjoyed a lot of great white Trebbiano wine, just as travelers do today. And the story ends in Rome, which is the eternal city where Michelangelo intended to build the tomb of Julius II.
Okay, now this long and winding road, it took a big part of his life. I mean, what, from about 1505 to 1545? That's 500 years ago.
He started it when he was an optimistic young man of 30,
mm-hmm.
and he finished it as an old man of 70.
What a story. I mean, we're all so enamored with Michelangelo, but this is like a psychological study of him almost. What is the vision of this tomb, first of all? Just what did he intend to build?
Well, the tomb was supposed to be huge. He was intending it as his magnum opus, bigger than David, bigger than the Pietà. What the tomb originally envisioned was a 50-foot tall tomb to bury this pope, Julius II. It was going to be three stories tall, made completely of marble, and bristling with some 40 statues, many of the statues as big as David.
So that would have taken, realistically, lifetimes to do.
Exactly. It was an undertaking that really hadn't been done for 1,000 years, since the ancient Romans built their mega projects. It was kind of like building a medieval cathedral, but Michelangelo intended to do it in his lifetime, all by himself.
Now, audacious as that must have been, and I think unrealistic as that must have been, even if everything went smoothly, a word I learned in your book, Michelangelo at Midlife, is non finito.
Unfinished.
Unfinished,
yes.
Yeah.
And it was something that Michelangelo struggled with the tomb, but it was also something he struggled with in his other works in life. And that's very much what the book is about. Michelangelo had this great audacious dream, but then life got in the way.
Yeah.
And he ran into detours and delays, budget shortages, fickle popes, other projects that he was getting asked to do, all while what he was really trying to do is complete this magnum opus of the tomb that would cement his legacy.
Wow. And today it's kind of like the splattered remains of his tumultuous life scattered around the museums of Europe. I mean, when you think about what was sculpted because of the tomb but never ended up in the tomb, you can find it. It's almost like a grand tour of Europe.
You're absolutely right. He carved statues that were never even put on the tomb. Those are the ones that, as you mentioned, are scattered all across Europe.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Gene Openshaw, and his book is Michelangelo at Midlife, Chasing the Tomb of Julius II. And Gene joins us now to get into Michelangelo's psyche, to get into his mind, to get into his frustrations as he tried to put together this audacious project. So, Gene, some of these works of Michelangelo that we all know and love.
We do. For example, here's one that many people will know. Many people have gone to see David, right? Uh-huh. Well, David wasn't intended for the tomb. But when you see David, many people notice, oh, well, what are these four statues that line the nave leading up to David? Those were intended for the tomb. Those were the prisoners. They were going to be some of his greatest works. But as visitors to David can see, they were left non finito.
And when you look at David, you see finito. I mean, that's polished and beautiful. And then you look on your left and your right, and you see these are more than statues. These are power sources.
That contrast really tells a lot about the story of the tomb of Julius II. Michelangelo began the tomb just as he had finished David. He was a young man in the prime of his life. He was Earth's greatest sculptor. He was like a young David. And then, when he began the project, the prisoners represent the next 40 years. The struggle that he had to finish the prisoners and to finish the rest of the tomb.
And those would have been in his ultimate vision?
Well, ultimate vision is right where we're getting to it. He kept changing his vision all the time. At one point, those two slaves would have flanked either side of the ceremonial doorway that led inside the tomb where Pope Julius II would have been interred.
So this tomb that he envisioned was like a giant marble pyramid, just ringed with symbolic statues. Was it going to be a pyramid that was actually in St. Peter's Basilica?
Exactly. That was his initial vision, was going to be this 50-foot-tall, three-story statue that would stand in the center of St. Peter's, right in the heart of Christianity.
And it ended up in a small church that very few tourists go to.
Don't give the story
away.
Come on.
But ultimately, we know Moses. We go to the St. Peter's in Chains Church, about a 10-minute walk uphill from the Colosseum, to see Michelangelo's masterpiece, Moses. But I've gone to that for decades, but I've never fully appreciated the fact that that really is kind of physically what ended up after all.
That's what ended up. For travelers that might have seen the great statue of Moses, you know, he's the one with the horns, and he's very powerful, and he oozes gravitas. He's muscular, and he's got a kind of angry face, bearded face. And Michelangelo eventually chose that statue to anchor the tomb that ended up in the church you're talking about.
Okay.
If you look at Moses and you see how big and powerful he is, multiply that by 40, because there were going to be 40 statues on the tomb, and you get a sense of Michelangelo's original vision.
Now, Gene, the lead character in the book, Sam, who is, I got to say, wonderfully autobiographical, he was struggling to piece these clues together 500 years later, and he ended up with quite an epiphany when he finally realized where the tomb was. Can you share that?
Yes. Well, first, I'll just kind of say, you know, the book is a story of Michelangelo and the tomb that's wrapped in a fictional story, this character of Sam.
Right.
So we follow Sam through the book as he traces the clues and tries to discover the meaning of the tomb. And then, like you say, where he finally gets near the end is he has a certain epiphany. And where does he have it? In St. Peter's, the very place that Michelangelo hoped to build the tomb but never got a chance to. What he realized, though, is that the tomb story, this long and winding story, eventually led Michelangelo to build St. Peter's Dome.
So you got the dome. That was like the grandest of Michelangelo's projects in many ways.
Exactly. He hoped the tomb would be his magnum opus. It didn't prove to be that way, but ultimately he did build his magnum opus, one of the greatest architectural wonders in the world.
And that Pope is buried right there under the dome.
And the Pope is buried
That's
right there.
That's how it functions. Congrats. Bravo, Michelangelo.
So you could almost say he built the tomb of Julius II. And what is the tomb of Julius II? St. Peter's itself.
And today, 500 years later, when we travelers go to Italy to find inspiration, we can find a lot of things that inspire us that, if you dig deeply, we're all part of this dream of a grand tomb.
And Michelangelo left us a lot of the remnants of the tomb that are part of the legacy of the tomb, and they are quite grand. He populated Europe with some of its greatest art. You go to the Louvre and you see the slaves. You go to see David, you see those prisoners. You go to the Palazzo Vecchio in Florence, you see his wonderful statue of Victory. But even more so, the tomb helped him to hone his own craft. So the style that Michelangelo came up with was largely carved with him carving the tomb. It influenced the Baroque world. And like we say, he built St. Peter's. And you know what is probably the biggest legacy of the tomb? It's just the ambition, the sheer audacity. Michelangelo gave the world the idea that a single artist could have such an audacious dream. And that dream has inspired generations to come, from Shakespeare to Beethoven to Van Gogh, and even down to a humble writer that was inspired to write a book about Michelangelo and the tomb.
And that man is sitting right across from me now, Gene Openshaw. Gene, thank you for the audacity to try to put this all together and share it in a fascinating read. Again, the book is Michelangelo at Midlife. Thanks, Gene.
Thank you, Rick.
You'll find more at ricksteves.com/radio. What art have you made it a point to visit in person? We'll check in with listeners making their own art itineraries in just a bit, right after we enjoy The Art of Good Living in Dublin and hear what's new in the Irish capital. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves.